You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony.
Okay, I'll be right back. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, now you're out of the room, Rick, and you've probably left it running. I'll just do a little Michael Caine impersonation for you. Okay, from Zulu. Do you remember that film, Zulu? Anyway, this is how it goes. It goes, "Don't throw that bloody spear at me." Okay, so there's a little gif for you when you're editing. Or from The Italian Job. "You're only supposed to blow the bleeding doors off." There we are. Locked room mystery honoured. Excellent. Well, you have some little presents for you there.
Oh, very good. Yeah. I'm glad.
Okay.
Let me see here. My brain is engaged. Let's see. Disconnect from teenage son. Accomplished.
Good. You got teenage son, have you?
Two, really.
Oh, really? How old are they?
19 and 16. Boy, yeah.
Do they speak in mumble grunt? And only in mumble grunt?
Yeah, basically they're speaking, you know, fuck you.
Yeah.
Fuck that dad.
Yeah.
Fuck that.
Yeah.
Fuck that dad.
Yeah, you really pissed me off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, now, you jerk. You fucking jerk. You pissed me off.
Now you're plosiving, so move that.
Oh, I'm a...
Yeah, move the microphone to the side.
About sort of there-ish?
That's good.
Can,
yeah.
Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers.
And you're just dandy.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
let's see, we've got 6 minutes, 4 seconds. So there we go. Fire away.
Okay, this is one of the chapter headings in The Big Over Easy. And these are all in the guise of newspaper stories, which I do like playing with because it's a wonderful way of condensing text. Anyway, this one is called "A Locked Room Mystery Honored." The entire crime writing fraternity yesterday bade a tearful farewell to the last locked room mystery at a large banquet held in its honor. The much-loved conceptual chestnut of mystery fiction for over a century has been unwell for many years and was finally discovered dead at 3:15 a.m. last Tuesday. In a glowing tribute, the editor of Amazing Crime Stories declared, "From humble beginnings to towering preeminence in the world of mystery, the locked room plot contrivance will always remain in our hearts." DCI Chimes then gave a glowing eulogy before being interrupted by the shocking news that the locked room concept had been murdered, and in a locked room. The banquet was cancelled and police are investigating.
We're speaking with Jasper Ford. He's the author of The Air Affair, Lost in a Good Book, The Well of Lost Plots, and Something Rotten. His new novel is The Big Over Easy. Welcome to the show, Jasper.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Jasper, I guess the first thing I have to ask you is, do you like the mystery genre or do you hate it?
I don't know. I mean, I think genres are wonderful things, and you look at them and you love them, and then you look at the things that make them slightly corny, and the things that there are so many books, right? There are so many books in any one genre that it is not possible to have a new take every single book. So there are always these funny little sort of plot contrivances that come around again and again, that I think are just grist for the mill for my kind of books. So I do love the genre, but I also have a sort of grudging sort of disrespect for sort of plot devices that do tend to come around with startling regularity.
Tell us a little bit about this world you've set up. You created it in the Air Affair and went through four books with Thursday Next. Now it's about 20 years later, and we're up with DCI Jack Spratt. Tell us about this literary world you've created.
Well, this is a world which is really sort of separate from the Thursday Next world, I think, in some ways, but not always. The basic idea here is that nursery rhyme characters actually live amongst us. You know, perhaps we don't notice them so much because we're disinterested in them, but they do, and they don't know they're nursery rhyme characters. And of course, because there's so much violence in nursery rhymes, you know, that it's full of dismemberment, disfigurement, people being boiled alive, people being eaten, you know, fattened, children being fattened up and eaten by sort of repulsive old women living in sugar candy houses in the middle of the forest, this sort of stuff. And of course, if this is so, then we need a nursery crime division, a policing agency, to actually, you know, look after the sort of crimes committed by nursery rhyme characters.
Tell us a little bit about your character here, D.I. Jack Spratt.
Well, Jack Spratt runs the Nursery Crime Division, the NCD. The NCD is not a sort of place you'd want to go if you were a career police officer. It's a bit of a dead-end job, and it's where the kind of losers kind of end up. Jack Spratt enjoys being there. He doesn't quite know why he likes it, but he does feel that he belongs. And he's the one who has to really sort of battle against increasing sort of disinterest from other police officers and the world in large to help nursery rhyme characters find some sort of justice.
In your novel, your new novel, you play a lot with the mystery genre. It's very interesting because you create a very gritty, dirty, low-down world of grimy houses covered with mud, covered with filth, soot, grime. Mm. And it's very realistic on one hand, yet living in this place, you have Humpty Dumpty. You have Rumpelstiltskin. Mm. Tell us about that dissonance that you create between the utterly realistic and the completely unrealistic. What made you choose to do that?
I think this is something also that goes back to the Thursday Next series. It's what I call fantasy ordinarification, or a sort of domesticity, a sort of fantasy, domestic fantasy, if you like. And what I'm trying to do here is take very bizarre situations and very bizarre characters, which are clearly completely impossible in our world, and make them not only plausible and believable but likely in the world that I create in the books. So it's important for me to actually write a book which is very recognizable as our world, and then place amongst them characters and situations which, while impossible within the world I've created, actually seem almost likely and actually humdrum and rather boring. And I think that just makes for a sort of sense of realism, you know, within the book that maybe it wouldn't have otherwise.
Create a really unique dissonance, because on one hand, you've created...
What does dissonance mean? I don't understand what dissonance means. Rick, tell me. Help me here. Help me out.
Dissonance is a kind of fighting forces. On one hand, you've got a compelling mystery, and it's a mystery that, were it not for the main characters being Humpty Dumpty and you, Jack Spratt, and having beanstalks and such, would be something not out of place in like a Graham Hurley novel.
Oh, I see, right.
So you've got that, and you take that mystery totally seriously, yet you've got all these fantasy aspects. What made you decide to like try to force, you know, chocolate and 40 weight motor oil together in a delicious sandwich?
Yeah, I think this, I mean, fundamentally what I was trying to write was a crime thriller. And I always enjoyed crime thrillers, and I think it was without the framework of the crime thriller, then the book can't really work, because it is essentially, you know, Humpty Dumpty is off the wall, he's broken, somebody's responsible. And I like the genre, the crime thriller genre, and that's not to say I can't poke a little bit of, you know, fun at it as well. But first and foremost, I did want it, basically on two levels, a very complex, you know, plotted story, you know, about, you know, somebody who's responsible, lots of red herrings, lots of suspects who could have done it, who might have done it, did they or didn't they. But on top of that, I also wanted to have this kind of silliness. And it's really, yeah, it's like having a... I don't know the best way to describe it. It's like having, you know, a sort of hardwood mahogany with a sort of strange, sort of rather odd veneer on the top. It's, I don't know, is it like sort of painting an oak paneling with paint or something? I don't know. It's a strange way of dealing with it. And I don't quite understand it myself, perhaps. But it just makes it, I don't know, just makes it somehow... I don't know. Obviously, I have to deliver. I mean, I think when you write a crime thriller, you do have to deliver. And I always feel that... you know, you don't want to sort of cheat readers. No matter how sort of daft I make the situations and the characters, it's still, you can still cheat readers out of a good story. And I'm always very, very conscious that I have to deliver not only bizarre characters and bizarre situations, but actually a good story behind it. And I think that was the point of The Big Over Easy.
It's really fun. Now, one thing that I noticed about this novel was that you seem to kind of have it out for the new genre of forensic detection. Tell us a little bit about the conflict that develops here between what I guess traditional detection and forensic detection, because you really let it loose.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, how detective fiction has changed. I mean, the detective fiction that I really loved was the sort of Agatha Christie and the sort of Ellery Queen, where they were really closer to crossword puzzles. You know, that was the kind of, you know, stuff I liked, where the author would string you along and then totally deliver something very unexpected at the end, but also have put in enough clues early on in the book for you to go, oh, I should have got it, you know, oh, brilliant, you know, oh, I love that. And I kind of like that. But I also have read a few contemporary novels, which are less about sort of, you know, who done it, but more a sort of how they done it, which I think is less interesting to me. And I think there's a lot of sort of pathology-based, I mean, that's a new genre, basically, the pathology-based crime thriller. And I think, I don't know, I just found them all slightly, I don't know, I just didn't like them as a series. I love this sort of idea of a detective who purely through cerebral means, you know, can discover who has done the murder. The idea of, you know, dissecting people and, you know, going on into all that sort of science about it, it's all just a bit icky, to be honest.
Your novel also includes a lot of interesting aspects of... Your novel is a fascinating, this is why we have digital editing.
Of course. We'll just go back up a second. Okay, you can go now.
Your novel is a fascinating commentary on crime and the media. In your novel, the law and order, forces of law and order, shape the investigation to provide an interesting story. Tell us a little bit about why you decided to take this tack.
Yes. Well, this is an interesting thing, and I think there is a blurring of the line between what is entertainment and what is news and what is, you know, what is crime. And fortunately, in the UK, we still have the BBC, you know, thank God for that. And they just deliver news. Now, we also have an independent television station, ITV, and Channel 4, which deliver news as entertainment. And there is a huge difference between the two. And I think it's almost sort of rather sort of offensive in which the way media, you know, if there's some terrible murder, the media turn up in droves. And this isn't news reporting. You know, this is purient interest, which is being sort of told. We're told it's news, and then we can say to ourselves, oh, it's news. That's why I'm interested, so that's okay, you know, because I'm interested in current events. Hey, you know, I'm a sort of, you know, I'm a Renaissance man. But it isn't. I think it's, you know, it's like news is entertainment. And I think that's one of the points I was trying to make in the book, is that sooner or later, and I'm not saying this about police, this isn't about a criticism of police, it's a criticism of the media and the way in which they look at things, is that sooner or later the media will try and change the, you know, the way that murders are investigated so it makes a better story, you know, and will try and change and make up things just to make a better story. And I think they do, actually, some of them, some of the worst offenders, this actually do sort of change facts to make them into interesting stories.
Sure, it's all in a way that it's reported. You can report something as a series of events, or you can report it with a plot.
Exactly. And this is the point in the book, that if you're a successful sort of policeman in this book, is actually the litmus test of a good investigation is not whether you get a conviction or not. It's whether you're actually published in this Amazing Crime Stories, which is this sort of true life crime adventure magazine. And if you can get a documentary made of it afterwards, and if perhaps, you know, then you get the movie rights. So there is having a bit of fun there at this kind of rather sort of worrying sort of trend we have at the moment.
One of the things that's fascinating here is the way in which you develop the character. You have a kind of a meta underestimation of the main character. Yeah. Not only do the characters underestimate him, but you write it so that the reader does too.
Yeah, I think so. This is something that one of my editors, my UK editor, came up with, and she was saying, and actually it was both of them, US and UK, and they said, because originally I made him a bit of a loser, and he sort of really sort of bumbled around and sort of almost came across the result by accident. And I thought, no, he should come across as a bit of a loser, but actually he's really switched on. So I think, yeah, the reader would underestimate him, and everyone else in the story underestimates him as well. And he has a lovely line, which is, you know, his sergeant says, you know, how sorry she is, and he says, don't worry, I've been underestimated before, you know, and by better people than you. And I think it's a great line, because what it shows is that he doesn't care. You know, he doesn't care what people think of him. He just wants to do the job, and he's an honest, good guy, you know.
I'd like to talk to you about literature as a technology. You seem to take apart different genres and different aspects of literature. Take literature apart and break it down into a series of tools. Tell me about why do you take this approach? It's a very interesting approach.
Why do I take that approach? It is an interesting approach. I mean, I whenever I look at a genre, whenever I'm writing, in a particular book in the Thursday Next series, which are much jokes about the classics that I make jokes about, then it's also about, let's start there again. The Thursday Next series, I have fun not only with the characters and the books, but also with the conventions of story writing. And what I'm used to is seeing people have fun with just, you know, ideas and characters. But I want to actually take it one step further. I'm always looking to take things one step further. And by looking at the way stories are told, you can actually find a huge amount of material for writing, you know, different ideas and stories. And I think certainly playing with the genre in The Big Over Easy, there are all sorts of things you can make fun of, which are conventions of mystery storytelling that come round again and again. And I don't know, I just find it amusing, to be honest. You know, whether it's, you know, putting Hamlet into the real world or a rage counselling session in Wuthering Heights. What you're doing certainly with this kind of fantasy is I'm really just, I think a lot of the classics are like, you know, very sort of like monolithic, you know, and I think they're very fixed in people's heads a lot of the time. And this is entirely wrong, because, you know, they're great stories. They're not just study text. What I'm doing is turning the sort of monolith on its block, allowing you to see just a slightly different aspect of it. And because a lot of the stuff I work with, my sort of primary sources are actually very familiar to people, this is sort of something new and a bit different. You know, it's like if you've only ever seen your house from one angle, you know, and then you see it when you're flying in an aircraft, you go, oh my God, look at that. You know, the tree in the backyard looks so small. And yeah, I never realized, you know, there was a little hump behind the house. It's that kind of thing. You take something familiar and then you look from a slightly different angle and you get a completely new perspective on it. And I think really that's what I'm sort of trying to do, not only with the Thursday Next series, but also with the Jack Spratt series, is just look at things from a slightly different light. And people, you know, seem to appreciate this, and you kind of think of things they haven't thought of before.
Tell us a little bit, how do you see literature as a technology that you can deconstruct into different parts? Plot, character, genre, convention?
These are interesting questions, but they're questions I do not ask myself when I'm writing. You know, when you're writing, there is a lot of writing that I call front of house and back of house, right? Meaning your head The front of the house is the stuff that you kind of you think up plot ideas and character names and things like that. And then there's back of house, where you write things down and you don't know why you're doing it. It just seems right, you know. And writing, for me, I don't give it a huge amount of thought when I'm writing things down. I do things I think are amusing and interesting and funny and clever. And it sort of just sort of comes out that way. I don't actually think of what I'm doing. But when you talk about sort of deconstructing, I suppose, yes, I am. I'm taking elements of stories and moving them around and shifting them around and everything. But I mean, I have to say, I don't really give it a huge amount of thought to intellectualize it in the manner perhaps you'd like me to. I don't know. Give me a specific example and I can tell you the thought behind it. Perhaps it's better rather than in a general way.
Well, for example, the piece you read in the opening where you talk about the locked room mystery being found murdered in a locked room.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's a loop. It's a little, what I'm doing is actually saying there's a kind of loop there that you have this wonderful contrivance, which is the locked room contrivance. And this goes back to Edgar Allan Poe, which is primary source material for any mystery reader or writer. And there was an American author whose name eludes me for the moment, who is the king of the locked room mystery. It's one of the best things, you know. The person's murdered, they're in a locked room, you know, seemingly impossible crimes. And because it's been used so much, I thought, well, how can we just turn this plot contrivance on its head, and how can I have a joke at the plot contrivance's expense, or even to not only in its expense, but also a sort of almost a salute to it, and of course to say, okay, it's now dead, and then somebody says, okay, but the locked room contrivance was found murdered in a locked room, so of course the contrivance is not dead at all. And this goes for a lot of you know, plot devices in books, that you can write books and books and books and books and books, and there is still another way of playing with an idea that seems incredibly old, in the same way that, you know, somebody could write tomorrow another really good locked room mystery. You know, you can't kill these things off. They just carry on going. And I think that's the gag behind it, really. But also it's an anthropomorphizing of the idea, isn't it? Because what I'm doing is I'm saying the locked room is that if the locked room idea could be murdered, then suddenly I'm giving it a sort of human aspect to it, which is another sort of strange way of looking at something, because then it becomes nonsense, because how can you kill a plot contrivance, you know, an inside a locked room. But it also asks questions, so, you know, there's an open-ended sort of mystery there already. That's the most I can explain about how it works. It just does work. It's a silly gag, but I don't know, it's back of house. It just is there. It happens.
The other technology that you work with, and this might occur a little bit more in the front of the house, is language itself.
Yeah.
You use a lot of puns. You make a lot of jokes. The Thursday Next books seem to work more around puns, and Jack Spratt seems to have more jokes. I'm wondering, is that an evolution in your writing? And tell us a little bit just about what you do with words.
What I do with words? Words are wonderful. The way one can use words is just tremendous. When I meet someone who use words beautifully, then I am overawed. It's a tremendous sign of not great learning, but just a brilliant sort of fizzing sort of intellectual mind. And, you know, I used to work in the film industry and know a lot of people from a lot of very different sort of, you know, areas of academic brilliance to nothing at all. And the people who could use language was all across the board. I mean, you know, we used to have you know, sort of carpenters and electricians who were sort of perhaps, you know, more described as people less academically well achieved, but no less stupid, but just that's what they were doing, who could use words in the most fantastic way. I mean, absolutely brilliant. Best joke tellers I ever heard were, you know, that kind of people. So it's nothing to do with one's learning. It's just a way that your mind works. And I love the wordplay. I mean, it's tremendous stuff. So especially ambiguous wordplay. Where it could mean, you know, it could mean two things, you know. I often describe as Lola Vavoom as an actress of some little talent, and of course that can mean two things, can't it? It either means she's got no talent at all, or she's got considerable talent. So it's things like that, you know, that I rather enjoy, and I just hear things and put them in, and I don't know, I just love playing with words and making up words and using words in different ways. you know.
As you create these pieces, are they created when you write the prose itself, or do you collect them for use later?
I often collect things. They kind of stick in my mind, and when I'm writing, I suddenly think, ooh, you know, what did they say the other day? Oh, that's right, I remember that. Yeah, I'll use that. It's sort of semi, you know, front of house, back of house. I don't know, but when I'm writing, I just sort of get it all down. I write dialogue first as what they mean, rather than what they genuinely mean, rather than what's going on underneath the dialogue. Because of course, you know, when you write dialogue, you've always got to have a sort of subtext to what's going on. You know, if what they're saying is what they're saying, then you know clearly you're in trouble as an author. So I kind of like the idea of I actually write it once and then I write it again and I start, you know, honing it all and actually add, you know, try and add a little sort of subtext to it. And that's usually when the sort of gags and the wordplay come in.
One of my favorite gags from your previous novel, Something Rotten, was the language that Thursday Next Child first spoke.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about
this. Yeah, this is Lorem Ipsum, which is a dummy text used by typesetters. And this is sort of Lorem Ipsum Dolores. It basically looks like Latin, but isn't. And this is genuine stuff. And it is used by typesetters just so that, because when you set text out, you don't actually want to have any English words there because people start reading the words when they should be actually just looking at the layout. And that's what Lorem Ipsum is. And I figured that little Friday Next, learning to talk, and children, as they do when they learn to talk, gabble a lot and of seeming nonsense. And I thought, well, if he's been spent the last 2 years living inside fiction, he probably would have picked up some sort of bizarre traits. And one of these, of course, is speaking nothing but Lorem Ipsum.
It's a really fantastic invention. Now, Something Rotten is this the end of the Thursday Next series?
No, this isn't. No, I think what we've done is what we're doing here is pausing a bit just to give her a break and me a break. And we'll be coming back to Thursday. Certainly, that writing books about books is, you know, it's almost sort of limitless what I can do, and you know, books and jokes about sort of conventions of storytelling. So no, we're definitely coming back to her, and you know, we won't leave her for long.
Tell us a little bit about writing in a series. You do it really well, and you do something in the Thursday Next books. You threw in a science fiction element, time travel, and at first it was just there. And I believe you told me when you did the first book, that you just threw it in just because you could.
Yeah.
It ended up playing a very important part in the series. Now, in the Jack Spratt book, you also throw in a bit of science fiction as well. And I'm wondering if you're more prepared this time for how it's going to play out.
Probably not. I don't know. I think that the science fiction in the Thursday Next book is kind of, there's a bit of travel science fiction, but also this time travel idea. I think what I was playing with there was the conventions of time traveling, you know, because this is impossible, clearly. Otherwise, there'd be, you know, thousands of tourists at the Sermon of the Mount, wouldn't there? Which there weren't, we know that. And all the great sort of, you know, historical moments in history would be crowded with time tourists, wouldn't there? So I don't think it'll ever be invented. But there is a very strict sort of grammar to time traveling stories, you know, that you cannot go back in the future and murder your grandfather. Now, my take on this is, why not? Why can't you do it? Well, you wouldn't exist. And you go, well, why wouldn't you? And you go, well, because you don't have a grandfather. I know, but you once had a grandfather, so isn't that enough? So my take on the time travel and the way I treat it in the Thursday Next books is that, you know, it can be possible. You know, you can have these seemingly impossible paradoxes and still carry on as normal, which I kind of enjoy. And also, I think what I was doing was taking a very strong narrative device or plot contrivance or whatever you want to look at it, and then relegating it to a subplot, and also giving it a humdrum domesticity that I think time travel should have. It's a bit ho-hum and boring in Thursday's world. If you work in the time industry, it's no big deal. Just, you know, one of those sort of, you know, things you do, like working in the postal service or as a plumber or something. And I think what I was trying to do this with The Big Over Easy, because one of the people who works for Jack Spratt down in Nursery Crime Division is someone called Ashley, who is in fact an alien. And it seems, from sort of reading between the lines and various little hints here and there in the book, that aliens have arrived on the planet Earth and are sort of assimilating themselves amongst us quite happily, but are terribly ordinary and very boring and like nothing better to do filing and sort of sit on railway platforms and jot down numbers of trains. Very boring. people, actually, aliens. And he's just arrived there, and he speaks in binary. He doesn't understand anything more than ones and zeros. So, you know, telephone numbers for him take a long time to dial. He can't get his head around them. I mean, and he's blue. It's really just incidental to the plot. And I kind of like that. It's this sort of throwing aside, you know, have it and just throwaway gags. I do like throwaway gags, you know, something very big and then just say, no, let's not use it. Let's just crush it down and just hint at it. But we'll learn more about Ashley, I think, as time goes on in the series.
One of the things you do in the Thursday Next books is you have events that happen in one book that actually do get followed up in later books. Mm. Now, what I'd like to know is when you set up the original event, do you know how it's going to play out?
No, I don't. The series, the Thursday Next series, the four books so far in the series, I do like connectivity in books. This is something that I do enjoy, and I don't know whether people use it a huge amount, but I enjoy using it. And the idea that you can have a plot device that starts off in one book and like sort of vanishes for two books and then pops up again. And this sort of does two things, I suppose. It really what's the best way to describe it? It rewards attentive readers, and attentive readers like to be rewarded, I think. It's like having Easter eggs. It's like, finding an Easter egg, something like that. I don't know. I just enjoy it somehow. But I thought when I was thinking up the series and I was first starting it with The Air Affair, which was originally a standalone book, I knew I wanted them to all connect together, you know, very strongly. But I had no idea what was happening in the series, you know, no idea at all. So what I did is I just left myself little off-ramps to actually pick up later in the series. And in fact, if you look through the books, if you read through the books again, you'll find all sorts of little off-ramps that I didn't use or haven't used yet. There is a subplot about Winston Churchill who keeps on being killed, and he nearly did die in at least four occasions, and we need him, clearly. But this is one I haven't used yet, but there are several others which, yeah, I just sort of left myself a little open-ended street and then thought, oh, how am I going to deal with this? And then two books down the line, I go, oh, I know, I'll do this. And then I sort of just make something up. It's actually quite fun, really, I must say. You know, sort of writing myself into a corner and then trying to write myself out again, you know.
Well, it's fun for the readers to experience as well. As a reading experience, it's really a joy. As you say, it rewards attentive readers. Mm. I want to talk about two aspects. Let's get back to this idea of the mundane fantastic.
Hmm.
You do this a lot where you take something wild and just out of space, a fantasy aspect, and you just bring it down to earth.
Hmm.
Tell me a little bit about why you like doing that. And
Well, humans are like that, aren't they? I mean, you know, a new piece of technology comes around, and within 6 months, we don't even think about it. You know, I mean, telephones now have, you know, pictures, and you know, you take photographs with a telephone. You know, now a mobile phone. You know, if you were to think about this, having a mobile phone 20 years ago, it's an extraordinary, extraordinary piece of technology. Now we have drawers at home full of old mobile phones that we don't use anymore. It's like Walkmans. You know, they're fantastic when they first came out. You know, pocket calculators, amazing. Now, I mean, you know, you buy them for a dollar. And I think that's what humans do. They're so readily adaptable to new technology and computers, you know, fantastic technology computers. Now we just swear and curse at them. You know, even, you know, they're amazing, the things they can do. And I think that's what humans are like. They're very adaptable. They get used to things very quickly. You know, if it doesn't seem like magic, then the technology is clearly, you know, very dated. And I think this is the basic idea that I take. With something like cloning extinct animals, you know, back from extinction, cloning animals back from extinction. My take on this was, of course, that yes, this would be very exciting for a while and then would become very boring and humdrum. And we join the story when it's boring and humdrum. And this is a realistic, as far as I'm concerned, this is a realistic way of looking at a sort of fantastic, you know, technology. Same with time travel. You know, if we invented time travel, you know, like in the next couple of years, within 30 years, it would be boring. You know, and we'd be wanting something else. Polaroids, you remember Polaroids? They came out in a minute, you know, and you thought, ah, that's fantastic. Now when you've got a Polaroid, you're going, come on, you know, and you're rubbing it and you go, come on, and it only takes a minute. So I think it's that, you know, technology and wonderful ideas, they become ordinary. And all I'm doing is reflecting that sort of part of the sort of human psyche, I think.
I'd like to also ask you,
We walk around the house backwards to try and fool the dog that time has gone backwards, and it's quite good. And so we walk around the house going, like that, and the dog's going, oh my God, I'm travelling backwards in time. It's quite fun, actually. We used to do, when I had the clapperboard, because I used to work in the editing room as well when I was working in the film industry, and when you're syncing up a clapperboard, right, it makes a very, very distinctive sound. So I used to actually do it in reverse sometimes, and it sort of goes like this. It would go, like that. And that's how a, you know, saying 28, take 4, clack, sounds in reverse. And there you have it.
We're back with Jasper Ford talking about his new novel, The Big Over Easy. Jasper, one of the things that's interesting about your work as well is your ability to take language and... God, shoot me now. Because my brain is just like... My...
Try it backwards.
Let me see here. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, Jim Henson.
Jim Henson, yeah.
You mentioned him in both Something Rotten and in The Big Over Easy. Yeah, what is it about Jim Henson that makes you equate him with Mozart and Einstein?
What a great guy. I don't know. The Muppet Show under Jim Henson was, I think, something very, very special. And it was all of a sudden as though, and Sesame Street as well, it was all of a sudden as though, you know, there was human kindness and warmth that had to be spread, and he was doing it. And I saw him being interviewed, and I just thought he was just the most perfect guy, because he was genuinely sort of giving, you know, and I think that was why I sort of mentioned him. I always enjoyed The Muppet Show. It was just the most fantastic show ever. That's really what I sort of felt about him, that he was, you know, was doing a tremendous job. I must say, tremendous job, and had his sort of heart in the right place. You know, the movies weren't terrific, but I don't think that was where he was at, really. I think Sesame Street was more him. And it just seemed so incredibly unfair that he died as suddenly and as, you know, as he did. And I thought, well, now I'll just mention him in the book a couple of times, you know.
We live in an age where science fiction has come to dominate the movies and even the television and even advertising. It's permeating the world of advertising. Mm. And your novels do something very interesting, because you use the technology of video and movie presentations within your novels. As you say, you talk about Easter eggs. You say your novels are bundled with special features. Mm. I'd like you to talk about the feedback loop between science fiction literature and science fiction in film and in other media.
Ooh, yes, tricky question. I think, I mean, media. I think the way people understand stories these days is people think in a very, we understand stories because there is a storytelling and story understanding grammar. And most people get it these days from movies and TV, because they're all pervading. If we got our storytelling grammar from books alone, then I think people would be slightly different, and perhaps a lot of the gags and ideas in my books wouldn't work quite so well. And I think what I'm playing on is people, how people accept and how people understand stories. And also, I think if you make satirical jokes about things like, you know, special features on DVDs, there is actually there is a humor there that you can pull out of almost any situation. And I like the idea of putting special features in books, just like they have them on DVDs. And there's all kinds of sort of little, you know, jokes one can play. But I think what I'm doing here is really just sort of feeding off a kind of shared, it's a shared experience, but not only in the stories that we read, but in the way we read them. And we read stories in a very similar way. I mean, it's just like, I suppose it's like painting or art. And things like that. I don't truly understand abstract art. You see, they look at me and it doesn't actually say anything to me. But I don't understand how people understand it. But I do know people who love abstract art and really get a huge amount of it. Now, they clearly have a better understanding of this than I do, and it's perhaps the way they've been brought up. you know, the way that I've been brought up in sort of, you know, Western art and everything, and, you know, more sort of figurative art, you know, that's the sort of stuff I enjoy. But if you go to somewhere like the sort of Australian Aboriginal art, you get a completely different take on the way art is perceived and its understanding of it. So I think, you know, what I'm doing is actually just taking on board the way that people understand stories and just sort of playing with that, really. It's a fascinating thing, and you could write volumes and volumes and volumes of books about it in a very sort of, you know, for a sort of perhaps boring and academic way. But I'm just demonstrating it within my writing.
You write about it in an exciting and entertaining fashion. Mm. One of the concepts that you talk about is the story engine.
Yeah.
And yes. I want you to talk about that and something else you told me about, emotional shorthand of storytelling. Tell us a little bit about how those work and how you use them.
Right.
And you layer them. You use it on the most basic level. We like Jack Spratt, for example, in The Big Easy. But we also like that he's a character that we underestimate, and we know we're underestimating, and we know the other characters are underestimating. We like him as a pertinence of the genre.
So what was the first question again? About story code engines.
The story code engines, yes.
Right, okay. So story code engines. This is in a book called The Well of Lost Plots. This was really trying to explain in a mechanistic way how books are actually made. And how we are able to read books at all. Because if you think about it, there are actually two different types of reading. There's reading that you use to look at road signs. You see, that's a completely different reading to the sort of reading we use when we read stories. And when we read stories, I think we're actually, we are kind of tapping in. The reader-writer kind of relationship is a very strange idea. You know, how does the imagination transfer from the writer through to the reader? And I was sort of having fun with this, because I was saying that this is done as a sort of computer program, because I was really having a sort of satirical jab at these endless upgrades we have to computers all the time. And I was saying that this mechanistic way, and it's through these big story code engines that can, you know, withstand 10,000, you know, readings of the same book, and figuring out a throughput, you know, 8 words per second throughput, and all kinds of manner of nonsense like that. But it is an interesting question about reading and writing, and I think it's the closest thing to telepathy that we possess. And I guess what any skilled author is doing is throwing up sort of like mnemonic markers in people's heads to actually, you know, bring forward a sort of emotional response. And yeah, I mean, what you say about sort of emotional flags, yeah, I mean, I think we are far more similar to one another than we perhaps realize, and we have these shared human experiences and shared emotional experiences, certainly about happiness and sadness and love and pity and shame and anger and all that sort of stuff. And I think you know, a skilled author will actually be able to manipulate that quite considerably, and that's why I think it's the closest thing to telepathy we have, which is very strange, isn't it? Because it's via just text, just words on a page, which is very odd, I must say. I think the closest thing to reading we have that isn't reading is radio and the spoken word, because then you're just listening to the words, but then of course you have the sort of added bonus of hearing the emotion through the speaker. Yeah, radio is like sort of reading plus, I think. But it is a very strange sort of transference of imagination from one to the other. I mean, if I say okay, imagine if you can a castle floating in the air at dusk above a calm sea, you know, with crows sort of cawing around the turrets, and you can make that picture in your head. Now that's an astonishing thing to be able to do. And of course, I'm not doing anything at all. That was neither a good description nor a very long one, but you've got it in your head. And that's what I mean by when I say something like, you do most of the work, the reader does most of their work. And this is a line in Well of Lost Plots that I kind of like, is that when a reader, when a reader, you know, says, when a reader says that a, hang on, I'm just trying to say this right from the book, when a reader congratulates a writer, they should actually reserve some of the congratulations for themselves, because they've done much of the work. And I think that's true, really.
There's a new form of technology that's just come out. It's called RPVS. And what this stands for is
rather than looking at a text electronically displayed on a screen, all the words at once, what this does is flash one word at you at a time. So it just streams at you. I'm wondering what you think about this kind of reading and how this might affect the reading experience.
I don't know. I mean, the cynic in me says it sounds like a complete load of nonsense, really. I'm sure I'll be totally proved wrong. The interesting thing about books, and especially when you are reading, is, of course, you do not read each individual word. Neither do you read the whole sentence. You actually look at shapes of sentences. One thing I found out when I was writing was that you can actually, if you have a fact in a sentence that you want to get across to a reader, you really want to put it early on in the sentence, because people read the beginning of the sentence. You don't want to have it on the right-hand side of the page, in the middle of a block of text, because that's where it gets lost. There is actually a way that people read text on a page, and very fast readers actually can scan past really important facts, and you can lose them. So it's kind of, that's why it's you use dialogue. If you want to get really a very strong, solid fact across, you use dialogue, because people read dialogue, especially if it's like dialogue that's like 5 or 6 words long. People always read that. But if you want to get something across, don't hide it in a big paragraph of description or exposition, because it'll probably be lost. In the same way as you're talking about this PBS, whatever, that it sounds very strange, because when you read a book, you kind of look at the shape of the words and the sentences and how they're laid out on the book. And that, I think that's almost of sort of equal importance.
When you write, do you actually pay attention to the way it looks on your word processor? Because you can't really predict how it's going to look in the book.
Yeah, I roughly do. I set out my word processor so that it's roughly the same size as the printed page when it comes out. And in that way, I can actually have a good idea of what it looks like. And it's important. And it's often, if dialogue crosses from one page to the next at the wrong place, I will say to the copy editors, listen, we have to keep this on the same page, especially because if it's a payoff of a gag, right, you can't have the setup on one page and then the following at the top of the next page is the payoff of the gag. It doesn't work. Often things will not work if they are on the next page, so I will actually say to them, put a line break here. And it is important how things are laid out on the page.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the political implications in Something Rotten. It seems like a much more political book than your previous works.
Yes.
You've done a lot of satire and jokes about popular culture, but you seem to be going after something a little bit more substantial in Something Rotten.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the faith-based corporation Goliath.
Yeah, well, this is the Goliath Corporation, which I do love, I must say. The thing about the Goliath Corporation is they have absolutely no shame in what they do. For a corporation, they're extraordinary because they'll just lie blatantly through their teeth and really don't care what anyone says. And I think that's entirely commendable for them. I think the bigger joke is that people don't seem to complain. They are sort of very much an exaggerated corporation. I was trying to find a way of making them worse, and the sort of cynic in me really said that, the Goliath Corporation should actually be trying to manipulate people even more. So they decided to change themselves into a faith-based a corporate management system, which basically means they're becoming a religion. And instead of you being paid, with cash, you'd actually be paid with sort of, faith coupons, or foupons, as they're called, which, you can exchange at, various sort of Goliath outlets for goods and services, which was just a sort of huge way of pulling the wool over the population's eyes, and allowing them to make even more money. It was just trying to make them worse, really, and even more cynical. So hard as though it seemed to be, I think I managed it.
Were you talking a little bit about some of the more faith-based initiatives we've seen in America? I mean, was that what you were playing for?
Not really. Not particularly. I think, faith is a sort of a bizarre thing, really. I'm a terrible cynic at heart, so I tend to look at all this as, with a rather jaundiced eye. It is a sort of strange thing, and I think I was just sort of poking fun of it. I poke fun at religion quite a lot in the books, with the I have the GSD, the Global Standard Deity, which I think was a fantastically good idea. Really, is just to take all the religions and make them into one, and then there'll be no arguments. I think there is a lot of fun to be had, certainly at without being specific as to religions, that the organized religion does to me strike a bit. When someone sets himself up as a leader, to boss other people around in whatever system it is, whether it's either governmental or religion or just, you know, in the office. It does strike me as just a bit, I think, ripe for comment and satire.
I wanted to ask you also about Hamlet.
Mm.
Taking on one of Shakespeare's most famous plays and taking the main character and bringing him into your book was a pretty daring move on your part. Didn't you feel a little bit or a lot of trepidation in doing so?
Yes. I mean, if I'd done it seriously, then perhaps it would have. I take my Hamlet is Hamlet light, really. The character, you know, Shakespeare's character Hamlet is an immensely complicated character who I obviously couldn't, you know, really do justice to in my book. So I just took one or two aspects of him. And the most popular aspects that people generally know about Hamlet is he's a guy who talks a lot and can't make up his mind. And I took that as my basis. And then I played with those particular issues and put him in the real world, you know, like, you know, in Starbucks, you know, where choice is everything. And of course, you know, to Hamlet, choice is a huge problem. He's all talk and no action, you know, which means he's the opposite of Chuck Norris, really, who is all sort of action and no thought, I suppose. And I think that was the part of it that I was actually, you know, playing with. But he's an immensely more complicated character than I think perhaps I give him credit for. But I like him. He's a nice guy.
When you do this, when you take these characters from literature, how much backstory and how much research? Are we seeing the tip of the iceberg, or are we seeing the entire mountain?
I think the important thing about that I feel very strongly within my books when I do attack in a sort of reverently irreverent way these characters, that I do actually have to know them to, you know, misunderstand them on a deeper level. And I think, you know, when I'm playing with someone like Hamlet, it is important to get a very good and clear idea about what the character is before I actually start maligning them. The same with Wuthering Heights, you know, or Jane Eyre. It's important because people who really know Wuthering Heights, you know, will be reading my book, and I don't want to appear to be a phony when they read the book. So you know, fans of Wuthering Heights will read Well of Lost Plots, and there's a sequence where they're all discussing, you know, their rage in this rage counselling session, and all the characters are pretty much, you know, fair assimilations of the characters in the book, and that's important to me. You know, I want the books to be understood on several levels, and people who really understand the characters, I want them to really appreciate the jokes as well.
Could you tell us a little bit about your research staff and your just your research databases and how you work that? And you work with some you have some help, don't you?
Well, my girlfriend helps a lot with research. I say things to her like, obviously I don't want to research things too much that don't need researching. So I'll say something like, you know, I need a page on a subject of whatever, Austin Allegro's or whatever. Well, actually, no, that was a bit more, really. I need about four pages on Austin Allegro's. And I need to know, for instance, if there are any recalls because of mechanical problems. You know, it's this sort of question. And she goes away, and, you know, she comes back with four pages, and I read through it, and I, you know, highlight things that I need. When I'm researching characters, and I read the book, Wuthering Heights, I reread the book, and then I had a look at a lot of critical essays of it. The great thing about you know, Penguin Classics, for instance, is they have very good forewords and afterwords, which go into some considerable detail about the book itself, which helps a huge amount to know how it was accepted at the time and, you know, how it's accepted now, and also my own take on it as well. That's very important as well. I mean, when I was reading Wuthering Heights, I knew I had to do something with it, but I didn't know where the joke came from. I found that it was written in seven first-person narratives, which I could clearly use at some point in the story. But I couldn't figure it out for a long time, what I was going to use in Wuthering Heights. And then, of course, it struck me, you know, there's a lot of this sort of rage, you know, underneath the surface, and everyone hates Heathcliff, you know, he's a horrible human being, apart from Cathy, of course. And I thought, right, let's make that into the gag. Take this sort of 90s psychobabble, you know, circle of trust, sit down, talk about our rage, you know, as we meant to do in the 90s. And put all the characters there, and the scene happened, and it worked really well. I was very pleased with it.
When we talk about the reading experience, we normally talk about reading words that we see right on the page. With your novels, I get the feeling that
you could do a web-based version of your novel where practically every other word would be a hyperlink.
Yeah, there is. We actually, for a bit of fun, I think for the Air Affair, we actually have on the website, there is the first 5 pages, which is an annotated version. And in fact, you know, there is some little references, and you can click a highlighted word, and it comes up with another reference and explains why I used that particular, you know, date or person or name or whatever. But then I was finding that once I was in this little pop-up box that you get, there was actually more to tell. And in fact, some of those pop-up boxes have secondary pop-up boxes after them, because everything, you know, leads on to something else. It's just like a huge network of ideas and connections and everything else. Great fun, but you're right. Yes, it could be. Take a lot of time.
Obviously. Let's talk about the movies a little bit.
Hmm.
I understand that people have been after you to sell the rights to the Thursday Next books. Have you done that?
No, not at all. My agents don't even tell me now when they've refused. I say, listen, as far as I'm concerned, you know, I'd rather it wasn't made than it was made badly. Or if I don't make it, it doesn't get made. And, of course, that puts everybody off. No, I mean, it's not necessary. I mean, many producers out there will, of course, regard books as nothing more than, you know, material to be primary source material to be used and made into movies. But I don't see it that way. The Thursday Next series would be very difficult to make into, I think, a good movie. It's probably not a movie. I think each Thursday Next book would be 4 1-hours of high-quality TV. That's the right format, you know. A lot of people say, oh, but you want to be movies because of the glamour and all the glitziness and, you know, and flash guns and red carpets. And you go, well, you know, if it's not right for the source material, then, you know, bollocks to it all. Oops, can't say that on radio.
In America, you can.
Yeah, can I? Yeah. If it's not right for the material, then, you know, it's not worth doing. So no, I haven't sold it at all. But my agents do know that I say, listen, if somebody serious comes and talks, you know, with a track record and a name you recognise, then you know, we'll talk, because I'd be sort of vaguely interested. But it's like having a good editor. You know, if the editor understands the spirit of the piece, then you trust them. Right. And any filmmaker, if they understood the spirit of my work, then, and I could trust them, then maybe I could talk. But at the moment, I don't see it.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the relationship of your books to the world of film. You have film stars. You refer a lot to the media. I wonder if you could, again, discuss for us this feedback loop that happens between literature and other types of fiction.
Yeah, I think this goes back to sort of what I was saying, I guess, about movie-making grammar is a sort of storytelling grammar that we understand really well. I think also a lot of there are some sort of little aspects of my book that feed into a popular culture, which is part of our shared, emotional experience, you know, that I was talking about. It's not just, you know, who's read Jane Eyre to find Jane Eyre funny. It's a lot of it is like the movies you've seen and the TV you've seen. So there's a big, big shared experience there that I can tap into. And one of these is movie making, of course. And, you know, and I was, you know, initially a big fan of the Star Wars series, less so now. In fact, I saw the last one. I was sitting in the cinema, sort of wondering quite what I was doing there. Which is a shame, really, I think. Fantastic missed opportunity to do something just wonderful and, you know, tremendous. But the first Star Wars, I enjoyed a great deal. And I thought, yes, I could put little sort of pastiches in here of Star Wars that were just sort of far off people, little far off these little, you know, mnemonic fags in people's heads. And they'd go, oh, yeah, I know, this is quite funny. So I think there's a situation in either in Lost in a Good Book or Something Rotten, which is very similar to the scene in the cantina in the first Star Wars, where somebody says, I have the death sentence in 7 genres, which I kind of like. I think that's a nice sort of silly gag, really, you know, and a nod towards those first 3 films.
Well, I'm wondering if you think one of the reasons that we're seeing such an explosion of science fiction, fantasy, and speculative fiction in film, do you think there's something about the genre itself that lends itself to the storytelling methods found in film?
I don't know. I mean, I think people see it. There are many people who see more movies than they read books. It's much easier to see a film than it is to read a book. You can get so many more ideas across much, much quicker than you can with a book than in a film than you can with a book, because it's, you know, it's very much sort of, you know, visual, and it's, I think it's actually a sort of lazy shorthand, if you like. It's a sort of lazy way of getting a story across. You have to work harder with a book. I don't know why we're seeing a sort of, you know, explosion of different ideas, but movies have always been very experimental. In fact, probably more so than books, because producers are looking for some new angle that they can exploit and something that's new and different and exciting. And, you know, with the advent of CGI, computer imaging, you know, there's a huge potential there for making movies now that we could never make in the past. And people are, you know, people are really doing some cutting edge stuff. Whether that's actually a good thing, I'm not really sure, because of course, you know, you can have the best sort of, you know, whoop-de-doo effects, but if the stories and characters and, you know, drama don't really match up, then it's a bit of a sort of hollow experience, really, sort of style over content.
Could you talk a little bit about the future of written fiction and written genre fiction? Where do you think you fit in? You said that you don't see yourself as science fiction.
Mm.
What do you see your work as, and where do you see it going in the future and fitting into this umbrellas of, say, speculative fiction in the future?
I've no idea, really. I write books that I find amusing to write. I'm delighted that people get enjoyment from them. I have no idea, really, where I fit into the whole great big, you know, umbrella. I tend to write books on a desert island, I must say. I don't tend to look at what contemporary writers are doing. I really don't. I mean, it's not that it has no interest for me. I just like writing stories, and that tends to be what I do. So I don't look around to see what other people are doing. Maybe I should. I don't know. But I do tend to write books just as though I'm the only writer, and just sort of get on with it and do what I think is amusing. So the future of writing, I've just no idea. If people keep reading it, I guess, yeah, it might. I think my writing has evolved. Certainly from the Air Affair, it's become, I think, sort of a bit more complicated. But where it's going, I've no idea, no idea at all.
Well, next up, I guess we can look forward to the story of the Fourth Bear.
Yes, the Fourth Bear. This is the second in the Jack Spratt series. Yes, which is really retelling or perhaps re-examining that strange story about the three bears and Goldilocks. You know, she trashes their house and is then found dead at Somworld, the First World War theme park next door. And the bears were the last people to see her alive. You know, there are all sorts of questions that you have to ask around the three bears story, like why was Mummy Bear and Daddy Bear sleeping in separate beds? That's obviously the first thing that Jack Spratt would notice when he goes into their house. To me, this obviously, you know, hints towards marital disharmony within the bear family. And you have to ask the question, well, why? And does this relate in some way to Goldilocks' disappearance?
Oh, that sounds very interesting. We've been speaking with Jasper Ford. His new novel is The Big Over Easy. Thank you for joining us, Jasper.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony.